The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So doubt and faith. I should say wholesome doubt and faith. There are sort of two kinds of doubt in Buddhism, and I'll primarily be talking about the wholesome kind. In Buddhism, in these Dharma teachings, this doubt plays a complex role. On the one hand, it's welcomed, maybe even, we could say, encouraged. And yet, faith is also a celebrated value and is one of the five faculties of five spiritual powers, five faculties of awakening, along with mindfulness and concentration, energy, wisdom, and faith. So I want to reflect a little bit about doubt and faith and how they fit together. There's this notion in the suttas, in the original Pali suttas, recorded teachings of the Buddha, that we reach a certain point in our practice where doubt is permanently dispelled. And, you know, on the one hand, I do see in practitioners that people do have transformative experiences from which they don't come back in the same way, that something feels deeply altered, and the hesitation that they might have had about the Dharma, that does dissolve. But the notion that we're forever without doubt, or that we should be forever without doubt, is, I wonder. For me, it has been critical to develop a sense of confidence in this practice. There's a great deal of relief that comes when there's some faith developed. And to honor the permanent possibility of being wrong, that feels important to me. And in line, in a lot of ways, with the Dharma teachings. And so I don't so much see it as an evolution from doubt to faith and then no return, but actually a kind of dialectic between doubt and faith, a wholesome kind of doubt. The doubt that normally gets talked about is the doubt of the five hindrances, the doubt of standing at the menu, looking at the menu, and you don't know whether it's going to be burrito or fajitas or something, or whatever the equivalent is, or you don't know, like, can I do this? What is meditation about? Is this of any use anyway? That's the kind of doubt and indecision that's sort of like paralyzing. The sort of doubt that I'm talking about is the doubt of the Kalama Sutta, the doubt of this famous story of the Buddha, where a group of people, who's sort of spiritual teachers coming through this town, and the townspeople are confused. They describe their confusion. They said, 2 weeks ago, this teacher came through and she said that her doctrines were all true and everybody else's were garbage. But then 1 week ago, this other teacher came through and he said that everything she said was wrong, and celebrated his own doctrines and disparaged the views of all others. And, you know, one came 2 weeks ago, one came last week, and we're confused. And so the Buddha says, yeah, you are confused. There's doubt here. And then he gave this famous kind of, it's really the Buddha's epistemology, really the Buddha's way of evaluating evidence, way of, I would say, balancing doubt and faith. So the Buddha says, this is how to live. Do not believe something just because it's been passed along and retold for many generations, or because it's become a traditional practice, or because it's known everywhere. Don't believe something because it's cited in a text, or solely on the grounds of logical reasoning, or because it accords with your own philosophy. Don't believe something because it appeals to common sense, or because you like the idea, or because the speaker seems trustworthy. However, when you yourselves know such and such things are unskillful, blameworthy, criticized by the wise, and if adopted and carried out, lead to harm and ill and suffering, you need to abandon them. On the other hand, when you know for yourselves that these and these things are skillful, blameless, even praised by the wise, and lead to welfare and happiness when taken up and carried out, then you should enter and remain in them. Now, this kind of way of interrogating teachings, way of questioning teachings, to me is really at the heart of practice, and in a more and more powerful way for me personally, because what I find is that sometimes we teachers, myself included, might even read this sutta, and we will often say, use that phrase, ehi pasako, come see for yourself, find the path for yourself. And at the same time, we're a little bit telling you what to believe, you know? There's a little bit of force being exerted. And that's okay. That can be done in a very open-hearted, skillful way. But this notion of truly finding a path, truly examining the teachings, is increasingly important in my mind, to really make it this our path, to become, as the phrase is, independent in the Dharma. So we don't so much find the Buddha's teachings, we really find our own. This is a kind of aspect of, maybe we say, wholesome doubt. Doubt, this kind of doubt is tolerable in Buddhism, encouraged even, in part because belief is not the refuge. Belief is not the refuge in the Dharma. We can believe the Four Noble Truths, yeah? We can believe various kind of teachings, yeah? But belief is, it doesn't have much liberatory power. It doesn't do so much for the heart. It's not that it doesn't help, right? Or that it's useless, but belief itself doesn't free the heart. This practice is looking for something that transforms us sort of like in the bones, you know, and that's a metaphor. And maybe now we're seeing that it's a neurobiological transformation. I don't know. But it's not what we believe. Belief is that comes cheap. Yeah. So this is Sam Harris, who's a long-term meditator, but sort of most prominent in his critique of religion. He writes, in many respects, Buddhism is much like a science. One starts with the hypothesis that using attention in the prescribed way, meditation, and engaging in or avoiding certain behaviors, ethics, will bear the promised result, wisdom and psychological well-being. This spirit of empiricism animates Buddhism to a unique degree. You know, the path, we could say, maybe begins with a kind of doubt. It begins with a wholesome kind of doubt. I remember when I was quite young I was somewhere between 8 and 10 years old, and I remember kind of reflecting on my life. And sort of like surveying my life and the paths that were being laid out, the kinds of models of well-being that were being offered. And I had a good childhood. You know, I was like lucky and that it was an easy childhood. And I was surrounded by people who were pretty happy. But I remember looking out on my life and having the thought, like, this isn't going to work out. Now, maybe that sounds like a depressing thought for an 8-year-old or something. But it wasn't then, and it's not. It still doesn't feel depressing now. It wasn't that I was hopeless about the future or something. It was just that I had a kind of early intuition that the basic way that we, the basic off models of life, the good life, the way that was being espoused, it wasn't going to work out for me. It's not that I couldn't have it, it's that it wouldn't work for me. And our practice, what launches us into practice at some level, is a taste of this, of dissatisfaction, of we could say, of a taste of the First Noble Truth, a taste of some insight that we're going to have to improvise here, you know? We're going to have to explore different ways of being happy. Because the standard kind of approach is there's a problem with it. And so we begin with some doubt, we can say. And over the months and years and maybe decades of practice, we keep revisiting this theme of doubt. We keep asking good questions about what we believe. We keep the willingness to let go, because we can get very cozy in our Dharma positions. We do. Again and again, we kind of settle into a nice, comfortable Dharma seat. And that's part of the process. And we should appreciate the security and joy and delight of that. And it can't last forever. We can't stay fixed in that Dharma seat. The Dharma, we grow. We must let go of our old visions of what practice was, of what we are. what is possible. So doubt. But if we stay completely mired in doubt, we don't move. Yeah. The Buddha said that even though there is this encouragement in, for example, the Kalama Sutta, to question, to be doubting in a way, said to get stuck in doubt is like being lost in a desert without a map. So there's a famous teaching. The Buddha was very interested in causality, right? And was interested in causality not in as a kind of philosophical or scientific curiosity, but because we have to understand causality to know why suffering arises and why well-being arises. That if we can't see any of the causal processes, if we can't make connections between a cause and an effect, then we're left to the kind of mercy of the momentum of the world. Yeah? And in the same way in science that one learns about causality in order to be able to manipulate conditions, right? So one learns about what, you know, organism causes what disease so as to be able to treat that disease, right? In the same way, the Buddha was interested in what is the cause of suffering. And famously, there's a whole kind of model of dependent origination that traces out how suffering comes to be. Much lesser known is a kind of model of how ease and freedom, well-being comes to be. Yeah. And so this is something that my first encounter, I think, was through Gil here, this teaching on liberative or transcendent dependent origination, which rather than tracking, how one, a causal process from suffering to death, yeah? Instead, the process is tracking the evolution of freedom. What are the causal steps in this? So Gil says, some of this is a little paraphrased. I should not be paraphrasing Gil in Gil's meditation center, but that's what's happening here. Just as one must first know oneself to be lost in order to search for a way out of the jungle, so one must know one is suffering in order to start a process that frees one from that suffering. This is the first underappreciated step. For some, it may take the form of feeling like one is missing something. For others, it might be an understanding of how the way one has been living really doesn't work. Between knowing one is suffering and starting to walk a path to freedom, there needs to be adequate confidence in the path and one's capacity to walk it. So it's said that from, in this process, from suffering, faith can arise. And maybe we say it's faith that there's another way of living. Faith that there is such a thing as a path. Faith that there's a way for us to practice that path. Yeah. And so we all have some confidence or faith that this kind of practice may offer some real benefit. Yeah? That gets us in the door, that increasingly gets us to stay. that keeps us engaged, because we may not be clear. We may not have even experienced the fruits of practice necessarily, but there's something in us that feels pulled towards practice. There's something like a growing faith. You know, for years, I think I didn't know what I would get with this practice. I did not have any, you know, I didn't get into the practice to address a particular form of suffering. I literally stumbled into the practice. Literally stumbled. And it's not that I wasn't suffering. I was suffering plenty. But I didn't start practicing to answer that suffering. It was more a sense of sitting down and feeling like, you know, I don't know what's here for me. I don't know what this is going to do for me. I don't know how happy I might get or not get. But something here is very vital. And maybe we call that faith. Maybe that's what was leading me onward with it. Before I knew what the Dharma was or anything, it's just some kind of intuition that I couldn't walk away from this. So Ajahn Amaro, the Thai forest tradition, who will be teaching at IRC in October, actually. He says, in distinguishing belief and faith, he says, belief fills the unknown with certainties, while faith trusts the implications of your direct experience. Belief fills the unknown with certainties. We can feel that, how the mind can get very imaginative, can sort of construct lots of ideas to fill the unknown. Yeah? But faith is actually, yeah, trusting the implications of your experience. Alan Watts puts it more succinctly. He says, belief clings, faith lets go. So we come, we sit, we kind of weather all the storms of what comes up in the mind and body. We stay. And over time, a kind of a quiet confidence grows in us that we actually can make progress. That usually comes with a great deal of relief and often tears. When people actually realize that this path is about them. Because we can practice for a long time sort of doing, you know, and it's like the part of us that thinks we should practice is kind of driving the show. You know, does that make sense? And we sort of just keep doing it, but it's almost like we're doing it for somebody else, and there's a real question about what our capacity to make progress is. And then at some point, a lot of times on retreat, you know, in the first years of retreat practice, there's this a kind of relief that comes when people deeply know their capacity to make change that is meaningful. They start to actually trust themselves and the path in a different way. Because in a deep way, we're pretty, I feel like we're pretty pessimistic about real change. When you really get down to it, we're, as a species, we're not, we don't have a lot of confidence that the heart can be transformed. And so when that realization does come, and sometimes it happens in a moment, and sometimes it happens just over time, but when that comes to some fruition, people, there's a lot of relief. There's a lot of relief, because up until that point, we sort of kind of held ourselves to be like the one exception to the Buddha's suggestions, you know? Do you know that feeling of like, yeah, the teachings make sense for them, you know, but for me, feels a little different. Like maybe I'm not in the Buddha's audience, yeah? This is also the time, this dawning of a kind of faith where people tend to see through a lot of the idealization of teachers. And it's the realization of, you know, like you sitting up there, whoever you are not special. And teachers are sort of generally pointing you back to yourself, reminding you that whatever goodness you see in teachers, in Andrea or Gil or whoever, that this is resonating with you because there's resonating with something good inside of you, with your own capacities. But we need to see that for ourselves. We need to see that for ourselves, to see ourselves, to see through some of that projection around teachers as somehow separate or special. So Sharon Salzberg, in her book on faith, describes, you know, she was on the very early retreats with Goenka, and a bunch of now prominent senior Western teachers in India. How many people have done Goenka retreats? Anybody here? No. You know, and she's now known as this, as the metta teacher, you know, a loving kindness, and is very eloquent and beautiful on the subject. And she describes first, I think it was maybe the first time doing metta with Goenka, she says that this is what dawned on her. The state of love-filled delight in possibilities and eager joy at the prospect of actualizing them. She goes on to say that this is what is known in Buddhism as bright faith. Bright faith. It's even got a name. And you see this. It's got a slightly manic-y kind of quality. There's a lot of energy. There's a lot of confidence. There's a lot of hope. And it's beautiful. It's a very infectious kind of beautiful thing to see. That sometimes, you know, you have the fortune to see that dawning on someone. You know, probably many long-term practitioners go through a phase. I know I had one where this is the kind of evangelical phase where you want to start making picket signs and get out there to the downtown area, and I had kind of like actual ideas of sort of like, yeah, you just want to yell at people to meditate, and this is bright faith, yeah. And it's powerful and important, and not, there's some instability in it, yeah? It's interesting, in the literature, the research literature on the connection between intentionality and behavior change, one of the findings is that we often think that it's like it's the intensity of a moment of intention that's associated with change, yeah. But that's really just one mind moment, yeah. It's like I am not going to eat pizza anymore, you know. And it's like, okay, that's just one mind moment. Let's see what that leads to in the next month or something, right? The research suggests that it's the continuity of intention. It's the continuity of intention that's more likely to catalyze change in behavior. Yeah? And the bright faith is like one of those mind moments where we're at the peak and it's like down with pizza. You know, right? But it's not stable. Not fully stable, yeah? And so there's a kind of maturation process where maybe there's sometimes called verified faith, but this bright faith that it propels us into practice. A lot of us probably did some of our intense kind of more ascetic practice during that phase where we're just willing to do whatever, and you know, like there's a strong level, it's a lot of energy, yeah. And then maybe the faith matures into something that's a bit more balanced, verified faith, where there's something in the heart has been touched so deeply that to abandon practice feels like it would be abandoning one's own heart. It just doesn't make sense anymore. And there's no need to defend the practice to anybody. There's no need to be evangelical. There's just a very kind of steady, you know, maybe unquestioned commitment to following, tracing out this path, following the implications of our experience. And I don't feel like the story ends there. I think although we may feel a kind of deep, heartfelt connection to the Dharma, to Sangha, to the lineage of the Buddha, there's still a willingness to grow. You know, in my personal experience, I sort of fell in love with the Dharma, you know, in a kind of steady way. It unfolded over the course of a couple years. And then for a long time, maybe a decade or so, just practiced with sort of my head down in a way, not blind or completely faithful or something like that, but I just kind of practiced steadily. And then more recently, there's been this question like, okay, I fell in love with these teachings, with what you, why you come to this center. I fell in love with something. Now, what did I fall in love with? What is the Dharma? What do I really know? What have I accepted? What do I simply believe because that's what I've been told or that's what I've been marinating in for all these years? And so more recently in my own practice, there's a kind of new openness to investigating and inspecting, like, what is it that I have fallen in love with? What is this path? What is freedom? And so there's a kind of willingness to let go of what our sense of the Dharma is. A willingness to be kind of, to be amazed by the practice, to be amazed in wonder about life. And maybe where the faith goes is the faith is ultimately in the looking, in the kind of courageous willingness to look. What is this? What is this life? What is suffering? What do I want? How can I serve? So the confidence grows not in a vision of how the world is, but there's a confidence in the looking itself. I want to know. Stop there. So any comments or questions from the group?
I've been studying Eastern psychology for many, many years, and I still am bothered by perennial question. Maybe it's unfair to ask you since you would look like a young person, but from all the books I've read and all the retreats and so forth, one of the things that bothers me is that, as I understand it, there's a 400-year gap between when Buddha lived versus when everything was written down in the Pali Canon. Do you see that as a... Do you sense that too as a reality, that that's true from your perspective? And the other thing is, if that's true, if it is true, and everything I've read is pretty consensual, is how do we know what the truth is? Because we could do a psychological experiment in this room, go from one end to the other, and we'd have a different message by the end of the row, famous, yeah, psychological experiment. So how do you, in your own mind, put that all together?
Yeah.
And I know it's a tough question, but, well, it's a question I still grapple with continually.
Sure. That's a great question. And by the way, don't be intimidated from asking me questions that I likely won't know the answer to. I'm really comfortable with saying that I don't know. So, I'm not a scholar, but my understanding is exactly as you suggested, that from the consensus among scholars is that it was maybe not 400 years, but some centuries whatever it was, a very sizable gap of time between the Buddha's historical life and the, you know, record. And that's not to dismiss the value of the oral tradition or anything like that, but that is an issue. And for me, the question it raises is what makes a teaching authentic? You know, even if the Buddha had like a super high quality sound system like IMC 2600 years ago, and it was actually recorded as clearly as Andrea's voice on Audio Dharma, and we had it all, what difference would that make? Some people would say, all the difference. I probably wouldn't. Larry Rosenberg, who teaches at IMS and in Cambridge, he said, what if the Buddha didn't exist? What if a bunch of smart men and women in Palo Alto made up the Buddha 100 years ago, and that figure, historical figure, didn't exist? What would that mean for how we practice? And his contention was that it wouldn't mean so much, because the authenticity is actually in the effects of the practice. It's in the Kalama Sutta. You know, we discover what is authentic by experimentation, by testing things out. The proof is in the pudding. And then Larry adds, but only if you taste the pudding, right? So for me, that historical, that gap is not so important. And increasingly science is being brought to bear on a lot of this, as a kind of arbiter of the evidence. This is a kind of enduring philosophical question. How do we know what we know? And what are the standards of evidence that count for knowledge? And I'm not going to resolve that question tonight. A lot of different kind of perspectives on that. But my feeling is even a perfect historical record would not resolve all of it.
I'm in the Eightfold Path series here, yeah. And right speech was just the worst rub on me ever. And so, you know, talk about doubt and faith. You know, it just seems like everything that came out of my mouth was just, where did that come from?
Yeah.
I have found it to be extremely difficult. By far the most difficult thing I've ever looked at, you know, in my short period here.
Yeah. How long have you been here?
Maybe about 6 months.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I really struggle with that.
Sure. For, you know, in the kind of basic precepts that we commit to, speech, right speech, sort of true, kind, timely, you know, spoken with, you know, with compassion to bring people together. That is definitely, for me, the last frontier, you know. So for one, be patient. And the Dharma is, it's humbling. It is humbling. It need not be humiliating. It gets humiliating when we start to personalize it, yeah? When it starts to deflate us and there's a ton of doubt and all that. That's when it gets humiliating. It doesn't need to be that. It is humbling. And just your willingness to actually bring up the question and be willing to grapple with it is great. It is an opportunity in the sense that our speech is, it makes the defilements clear. Greed, hatred, delusion, or craving, aversion, unconsciousness. It actually makes those clear. It's harder to see some of those forces in the mind in other spheres of our life, but actually in speech, it's like really clear. And that is a value. That is actually a value because we are kind of, that which is not seen is not healed. Yeah. And so this is the good news. This is the good news. As a practice, maybe you and I can chat a little bit afterwards. Yeah, but it's a rich subject. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay.
So I've been coming about the same amount of time, 6 months, and it's really been the mindfulness and the practice has really been helpful, you know, personally. But once in a while, I'll hear a teaching or something that kind of throws a hurdle at me that I can't quite get over. So the topic of doubt is really timely. So I'll give you a couple examples. Just a few days ago, there was a really cool thing we learned. It's kind of like metta, but it's a little different. It's like, oh, let's say your neighbor is successful, or and you might be, you know, jealous or something. But in the practice, you wish them continued success, and that keeps going. And in general, that's healthy, but it'll throw a block up once in a while, like, well, what if your successful neighbor is Bernie Madoff and he's stealing, and it's never questioned. You just wish the person success without ever kind of skeptically looking under a rock. Another example would be...
I'm going to jump in because that I can hear the doubt.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, our mind is like, it's like such a trickster, you know. I think in some, in different kind of traditions, it's sort of, personified by different animal spider is one of them. It's like it's a trickster. So their doubt will, and it's a different kind of doubt than the type I was talking about. It's the doubt of that gets paralyzing. That will throw up a lot of really convincing smoke screens and counterexamples, and we get really caught in this kind of thicket of views in the mind. And so you can know when you're bringing up Bernie Madoff, when your mind starts to like add the Madoff counterexample, an alarm bell can go off. Doubt. Yeah. Because what the mind is trying to do is, maybe in this case, trying to find a way out of that practice of mudita, of sympathetic joy. Yeah. You want to be really cautious about how that unfolds, because that kind of doubt will take you off the cushion, and it will empower the defilements in the mind. It will allow you and me, this is not just you, this is me too, to rationalize forces of suffering within myself. That's its function. It rationalizes our own suffering rather than looks at it open-heartedly. And when you feel that happening, that's the alarm bell. I want to look more deeply. There's something going on here. And your mind will come up with, there are many guises of the unwholesome doubt. Many guises. And we sort of get good at like sniffing it out. It's easier when you see it in others. In ourselves, it's trickier. But that tone of mind, that general kind of emotional atmosphere, we start to get a sense of what that is. Yeah. So we're at time, but maybe we can chat after. Okay, happy to. So let's just sit for a moment. So as always, whatever feels of use here, please pick up. And whatever feels wrong or extra, unhelpful, just leave that behind. And whatever goodness you sense here in the room tonight, may this goodness remind you of your own. May our efforts here tonight and in our practice, in our lives, may those efforts be of benefit for all that we encounter in small or dramatic ways. May we support the well-being of others, be a cause of less suffering in the world. So thank you. Appreciate your attention. Andrea's on, I think, teaching the month long, so I'll be back next couple weeks. Anyway, nice to be with you. Have a good night.